She completed her doctorate at the Harvard School of Public Health, and her research focuses on violence and health with a specific interest in intimate partner violence. And she's worked in countries including Nigeria, Iraq, Lebanon, Egypt, and Jordan.
Hi, good morning, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me to speak. And I'm especially excited to be on a panel with people who do infectious disease, because the key message that I want to make in this presentation is that violence, including something as sort of behind the doors as domestic violence, should be seen more in terms of an epidemic and in terms of an infectious disease, and something that we as a community, we as are responsible for above and beyond just the individuals involved in sort of a violent relationship. So again, the disclosures, I have no relationships to disclose in terms of financial relationships, and also I need to disclose that the views I present are my own views and not those of my employer, the UN. So quickly, why study violence in public health? Obviously, they are the direct consequences of violence on health, whether we're talking about injury, mortality, but also there are indirect consequences on the environment, on neighborhoods, on social cohesion, on the safety, on education systems. And therefore, if we really do want to take a social determinants approach to health, violence is a really important underlier of probably a number of poor health outcomes. But the question is, how do we study violence and health? And up to now, the large majority of violence research looks at individual level predictors of violence, especially in the domestic violence literature. So what makes a husband violent? Is it his unemployment status? Is it his alcohol use? Is it his education? Is it his socioeconomic status? But what I try to sort of do in this presentation is reorient the discussion to what makes a community more prone to have violence in the community, and what are the factors that we can address at the macro level? What are the policy implications for the broader community? And that's why it's actually great to be on a panel with two infectious disease presentations coming before, because I feel like you've sort of been primed to think about spatially about questions. Otherwise, if you're on a violence panel itself, you end up thinking about it at the very micro level. So is it an individual responsibility or a social responsibility? And the point I want to make is that there are tools, and what I use is a multi-level modeling, which is underutilized in the violence literature, which can help us sort of pick out these contextual factors while controlling for individual factors that we already know are predictors of violence. So above and beyond what is going on at the individual level, what can we do? How can we intervene at the neighborhood level, at the state level? So this research project draws on research from Nigeria, but in fact it's, it hopes to kind of be a more conceptual project to shift the way we think about violence. So it's Nigeria is a case study. I don't want you to come out of here and think that Nigeria is some sort of outlier where there's more domestic violence than anywhere else in the world. That's not the case. So what were the two aims? The first is to describe regional patterning. If what I've said, my hypothesis is correct, that it is more of an epidemic, we would imagine that there would be clustering of violence. If we find that there is no clustering, that there's a random distribution of households where there is violence, then it doesn't make sense to do what I'm calling for, which is multi-level modeling. But if we do find that there is clustering, then multi-level modeling allows you to think about, is it because of the compositional, the characteristics of the people living in those neighborhoods or in those states, or is there above and beyond some sort of ecological level variables that are important? And my specific sort of ecological variable that I'm interested in is social norms. So norms around violence, and I'll go into the data, but in many countries across the world, it is still viewed as justified or acceptable for a husband to beat his wife if she does a number of things transgressing sort of gender norms. So my hypothesis is that women living in communities that are more accepting would have a higher rate of victimization. So Nigeria, as I mentioned, it's a case study, but it is an interesting case study. It includes, it's the most populous country in Africa, But more interestingly, from a multi-level modeling perspective, it's interesting because it's a federal system. This means that there are 36 different states and a federal capital that have unique laws, unique socioeconomic sort of demographics, unique sort of spatial or state-level factors that may impact violence. So, for example, there's only a couple states in Nigeria where domestic violence is illegal. There's only a couple states in Nigeria where even women's shelters are available. So there are clearly spatial issues. And it's a really ethnically and religiously diverse country. 50% of the population is Muslim, 40% is Christian, 10% follow sort of indigenous religious. There are over 350 ethnic groups. There is a high prevalence of violence. So I'm going to present basically the results of one paper that I did on intimate partner violence prevalence, or the actual risk of being victimized, but also give you a few results from a paper on help-seeking behavior, because I think the conceptually both have a spatial, have a important social context to think about. So what are the data sources? I use the Nigeria Demographic and Health Survey. Many of you are probably familiar with the DHS. So the DHS is a nationally representative survey, and the sampling frame was the 2006 census. There were three questionnaires, a women's questionnaire, a men's questionnaire, and there was a special, and a household questionnaire, but there was also a special module on domestic violence. And this is why I use Nigeria, because there was very rich literature on Nigeria. I also use UNDP's Human Development Report, because they have something called the Human Development Index, which is basically a proxy for socioeconomic development at, usually it's at the country level. It's an index based on health, education, and GDP per capita of a country. But the 2008-2009 report in Nigeria actually created an HDI per state. And the other measures, so the key outcome measure was a history of spousal abuse. So women in the special module were asked if, since the age of 15, they had ever experienced a list of 11 things, from being slapped by their husband, burnt, threatened with a gun or a knife, kicked, to quite violent acts of forced sex. And if they responded affirmatively to any of those 11, we recorded them as having a history of spousal violence. And the main exposure, as I mentioned, was social norms. That was my main question of interest. And there isn't an aggregate sort of community-level social norms variable for Nigeria, so we created it by going back to the data, looking both at men and women answering the survey as whether it's okay for a husband to beat his wife if she goes out without his permission, if she neglects the children, if she argues with him, if she refuses sex, or she burns the food. And quite interestingly, I show these results because every time I see them, I'm shocked that, you know, 34% of women say that it's okay for a husband to beat their wife if she goes out without his permission. And as you see, the purple is women's response, the men's is the green response, and for every single of the five variables, women are more likely to endorse that it's acceptable to beat your wife. So there is something here about the sort of how do these norms get propagated intergenerationally. Like, women are important actors in that too. So what we did is basically we create a score from 0 to 5. If you endorsed it in all 5 cases, you got a 5. In 0, you got a 0. And we created an average based on the responses from all 33,000 women, all 15,000 men, to get a state-level variable. My sample only included 18,000 women, so it's a different sort of sample, but at the aggregate level, we created it based on both the men's and women's responses. So I've already talked to you a bit about the state-level measures. At the individual level, we controlled for known demographic and socioeconomic variables linked to violence, and we also had two violence-specific ones, which was a woman's reporting of witnessing, seeing her father beat her mother, and her personal attitudes towards violence. So the analysis was twofold. First, to look at aim one, which is the spatial analysis, was basically to look at the descriptive results. And then the multi-level logistic regression took place. We ran four three-level models. So it's three-level models because we have women nested within what's called a primary sampling unit, which is just the way that the DHS is done, nested within states. We only were interested in the actual fixed effects of state level and individual level. The PSU, you know, you have to have this third model because of the sampling design. So because women were selected from within these clusters, which are called the primary sampling units, you imagine that there would be more sort of correlation within samples. So you control for it through the modeling. I'm only going to present the results for Model 2 and Model 4, but I can discuss the other ones too. So what did we find? In terms of descriptive results, we found that of the 18,800 women who reported, who were in our sample, around 20% reported exposure to violence. So if you're not doing multi-level modeling, you'd say, okay, 20% of women in Nigeria report violence. However, what is quite striking is that there was significant clustering by state. So the state with the lowest level of violence, there was only 3% of women reporting, and the state with the highest level of violence, there were 50% of women reporting. The standard deviation is 13 percentage points. So clearly violence is not randomly distributed in Nigeria with those 20% falling everywhere across the country. There's clear clustering. You know, is it an epidemic? I don't know. The people who do work with epidemics might say there is something significant here. And similarly, the social norms score, it ranged from 0.2 to 2.02. Because conceptually that's difficult to understand what that means, I also created a score in terms of the proportion of people in a state endorsing violence in one or more setting. So it ranged from 9% in one state to 75%. So some states, 3/4 of the population, say it's okay for a wife to be hit or beaten by her husband if she does something that transgresses sort of the gender norms. So what are our results? The table all the way to the end is the full model that basically includes, it controls for all the individual level predictors. I haven't showed, if you see at the bottom, age, education, those were basically covariates, so I haven't showed what their odds ratio was, but some of them were significant. But my interest was, will attitudes towards violence matter above and beyond a woman's individual attitudes, the community level development, the you know, composition of the community? And they do matter, such that for every 1 point increase on this score, we find the odds of a woman being victimized by her husband being 80% higher. That's a pretty significant finding. We also find, of course, that her individual level factors matter, and the strongest predictor was actually witnessing your father beat your mother. And that also, to me, says something about norms, because it is an intergenerational perpetuation of violence. You've witnessed something, and therefore there's something going on in the community at the social level where it's acceptable, whereas, you know, there still needs to be a lot more qualitative research to understand it, but it's something that is not a characteristic of the husband. It is a characteristic of the wife's father, and therefore it is more communal as a characteristic. And her own views about violence are positively associated with violence. Now, an interesting result, which we didn't have in our hypothesis, is that states where there's Sharia law, so as I mentioned, about 50% of the population in Nigeria is Muslim, and a third of the states, 12 states, are under Sharia law. There seem to be a protective effect. So women living in states under Sharia were less likely to report violence. And there can be different interpretations of this result. And my interpretation, it's still a hypothesis, is that there is a risk in terms of empowering women, and that it's during times of transition where women are starting to break sort of gender norms that they might be more at risk of violence. And maybe in the states where there isn't Sharia law, women are sort of exploring going out of the household. And I say that this is my hypothesis because a factor I don't show is that employment also is a risk factor. Women who are employed were more likely to report violence than women who are unemployed. So taking the two together, my hypothesis is that it's just a temporal effect, that while women are experiencing, so in states where women are not as controlled, they have more chances to be out in the public, but also maybe in the household there is some more violence. And from the UN perspective and from places, you know, where we work, from a policy perspective, we're you know, that is our goal, to empower women and to increase women's participation in the labor force, it's important to think of some unintended consequences and think about how we might address them at the household level. So what were the sort of limitations and strengths of the study? Of course, this is a cross-sectional study, so there is a problem with causal inference. There's also a temporal consideration to take into account. Women were asked about their experience with violence since the age of 15, and the social norms were collected today. So maybe for some of the older women, norms have changed in the last 20, 30 years. But I would think that that would be an underestimate of the importance of norms. But again, there is some debate there. There is also potential for underreporting of spousal violence based on the norms. But the goal of this paper wasn't really to find the specific variables that we need to intervene on for Nigeria. The goal was basically to say, are there spatial factors? And if they are, should we be investing somewhere, should we be shifting the way we do research on violence? And I think that is the key strength. We do find that at least two of the three contextual factors are significant above and beyond after controlling for individual level factors. And if we are able to address some social determinants of violence, we may be able to be more successful with our individual level, you know, doing them in at the same time as individual level sort of interventions. And this is the first study in sub-Saharan Africa to examine this relationship. So quickly, I don't want to worry you because there isn't as much time, but in terms of, so once we can establish that there is a pattern of violence, our question was, well, do women seek help differentially because of the community context? So we sort of did a follow-up paper using the same data, but expanding the group of women who were included in the sample to include women who were unmarried too. So we said, among all victims of violence in the DHS in Nigeria, how many of them are seeking help and what are the factors that predict help-seeking behavior? So help-seeking, the literature on help-seeking behavior is even more individual than even the literature on IPV. So help-seeking behavior is often looked at from sort of the psychology literature. So what is it about women's self-confidence? What is it about their personal characteristics that make them able to stop violence, to leave a violent relationship? So our question is, what makes a community more likely to enable women to leave a violent relationship? So quickly looking again at the descriptive results. So in this sample, we had 22,000 women. 5,000 of them were exposed to violence. This includes the unmarried women. So the exposure to violence is slightly higher among when you include unmarried women, which is also something that we were surprised to find, because a lot of the literature on violence against women in the developed world, in the developing world, is really about spousal violence. But we're finding that there is actually a lot of dating violence and a lot of other sexual and physical violence from other partners outside of marriage. But about a third of them sought help. And when we say sought help, we have to remember the context here. It's not seeking help from a legal or medical officer. It's just seeking help from a neighbor or a friend to stop the violence happening again. So it's really about informal help seeking that we're looking at. And we find, again, a spatial patterning of help seeking behavior. So in some states, only 12% of women sought help. In other states, 65% of women sought help. So again, this calls into question the way we think about violence and about help seeking. If there is such spatial patterning, clearly the way we targeted interventions and think about violence at the household level has to incorporate some of the broader contextual factors. Again, the violence prevalence was also more striking here because we have the higher prevalence, including the unmarried women. In one state, it was as low as 4%, in another state, as high as 78%. So that's quite striking. And then the proportion of women endorsing violence, of men and women endorsing spousal violence, is the same from the last survey. So what are our results here? Here we also find important contextual level factors. So again, multi-level modeling allows you to say, above and beyond all the individual level factors, you've controlled for those, is there something going on at the contextual level? So it's not that the human development is just a sum of the individual women and men's social and economic status. There's something above and beyond that that seems to be significant. And we find a negative relationship with violence prevention. This means that in states where there is more violence, women are less likely to seek help. And it doesn't look like it's a big effect at 0.98, but if we just look at one standard deviation, so a state with one standard deviation less violence, women are about 35% less likely to seek help. So this has really important implications for people who are doing violence interventions. You target your intervention to a state that has high prevalence of violence, but nobody comes to seek your services because there's something going on that they're less likely to seek services. So you have to address, the conclusion that I come to is that you have to address norms at the same time as you're making services available. Of course, norms didn't seem to be significant here, but I think there is something going on with the violence prevalence and the norms being very closely linked. Sharia law was not significant. Human development was. So just a state that just has more, that is more developed, women are more likely to seek help. And you can have a couple explanations here. One is that there might be more services in those places where there is more development. Another one might be that women are rational actors. They say, my community is really poor, there's all these problems, no one's going to do anything about me being a victim of violence. But in a richer, wealthier, sort of more developed community, they see the opportunity for help being greater. And at the individual level, there were some important factors that were significant. So what are the conclusions and implications of this research? I think I've made this point many times, but basically that this geographical patterning of both the violence exposure and help seeking suggests that we need to further explore contextual predictors and to better target our interventions. We do need future studies to better understand social norms. So what we created from the DHS is a very crude measure of social norms. But it's also the first time that someone decided to aggregate up this questionnaire. The DHS has these questions on attitudes towards violence in pretty much all their surveys. It's not in the domestic violence module. It's included in the main men's and women's questionnaire. So we have attitudes towards violence for so many different countries. This research can be done in other settings by aggregating up at that community level. We need to understand better differences between married and unmarried women, and that's sort of a call for practitioners and researchers in the developing world to sort of feel like it's politically difficult to talk about violence in intimate partnerships outside of marriage. But if there is such high rates of violence outside of marriage, we need to start studying it. And then we need to think of the types of help seeking and related health outcomes. So the women in Nigeria sought help from informal sources. So they're not seeking help for the injuries that they're facing. They're just seeking help for someone to stop perpetrating the violence again. Clearly, we need to understand why they're not going to sort of a medical or a public health professional. And the interventions that might work in the US or Canada or in the Western world might not work in those settings. And the bottom line is that multi-level modeling offers really some new insights. And there's a really interesting NGO working in the U.S. called Cure Violence, and it started by an infectious epidemiologist. And he basically said, I'm going to use the lessons learned from infectious disease to address gang violence in the U.S. Gang violence, there is more of a network, by definition, you can think of more network and more spatial clustering. But my papers show that even something that happens behind closed doors, where you would imagine that it's not husbands talking to other husbands about how they're beating their wives, that there is a spatial patterning and some sort of contagion happening through norms. So it makes the case for sort of shifting the way we think about violence altogether. That's it. Thank you. Yeah. So it was a conceptual question, right? So I thought that social norms is more than just a collection of individual people's attitudes. And what we included at the individual level was a woman's attitudes towards violence, because the previous literature has shown that if a woman herself is more likely to endorse violence, she's also more likely to be a victim of violence. And that might be a reverse causation problem. You know, a woman who has experienced violence might then say it's acceptable because she doesn't want to leave her husband. But we knew that there was an association at the individual level. So we knew we wanted to include it there, sort of as a variable that has been shown in previous literature. However, this is the first time. What we did was we included now not only the respondents, like the women who responded to the domestic violence module, but also all the men in the community. So there were 15,000 men interviewed, all the 33,000 women in the sample, and created this aggregate social norms, because we thought that that actually represents the state level. This, you know, the sum of people's attitudes, whether you're a victim of violence or not. And it was really, that was the main question of interest, because we thought that social norms as a construct, that has an effect above and beyond an individual person's beliefs. So if you live in a community, you or I might live in a community where I don't believe violence is okay, but if everybody around me believes that violence is okay, my chances of being victimized are higher. So that's kind of what the difference is between including it both at both levels. And that's quite common in the multi-level modeling world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you looked at those regions in terms of help-seeking behavior, was there any relationship?
No, there wasn't an association between norms and a statistically significant association between attitudes and help-seeking. There was an association between the actual prevalence of violence. And because prevalence was linked to norms, then there might be, you know, after you've controlled for both, it's the prevalence that seems to carry that forward. Yeah. Sure, that's a really interesting question. We did, so as I mentioned, there's basically three levels. Women nested within these primary sampling units, which for Nigeria was about 80 households. There were 888 sampling units. So we did wonder whether that's the level of interest, that neighborhood, norms at the neighborhood level, or is it at the state level? And for our, I mean, before going into this, I thought the state would matter more because of the legal structure at the state level. And what we did find actually is that there is more variability between states than within states. And then we redid the model again, looking at all the state level factors. We couldn't do clearly the HDI. The HDI was the state level, but the social norms at the PSU level. And we found that the magnitude and direction and significance stayed the same. Not the magnitude, the absolute magnitude was slightly different, but the effect was the same. So there's that. We did a sort of a robustness test. But it was more interesting to us to report the state level, because we found that there was more variability between states than within states. So, but I know for India, I know actually the one person on my on the paper, this was actually my dissertation research, so on the committee, is Subbu Subramanian, and he knows the India DHS quite well, so he was quite convinced that we would find results more at the PSU level, but we didn't find that. So maybe for India it would be at more of a neighborhood or a sub sort of level. And the rural-urban thing we included as an individual level control. Sure. So the DHS when they do this domestic violence module, they do it to one randomly selected woman in the household. If there is absolute privacy, they can do it in a private room, and they can assure confidentiality. So we did have something like 6,000 women missing data because probably there wasn't confidentiality assured. Now, in terms of whether they're reporting or underreporting, a reason why we just dichotomized those 11 questions, I said that there were 11 things that they ask, whether, you know, you're being slapped, hit, beaten, burnt, that increase in severity. The reason why we didn't look at the differences between those, we thought that maybe a woman who's experiencing very severe violence, she might report it as a slap or a hit. And because there is such high acceptance of violence, we didn't think that there would be the same sort of, concern with sort of underreporting, because if 40% of women say it's okay, then they might be able to report it.
My follow-up question is about norms, and you mentioned briefly about changing norms, but just within the prevention programs that I've seen here in the U.S., it focuses on getting women into prevention. I'm curious about getting men into prevention.
Of course. I mean, that's why we included men's attitudes in this sort of norms variable. And there is some really exciting research and sort of advocacy work going on, especially in South Africa. I think it started over a decade ago with men speaking up against domestic violence. So, of course, men have to be involved. And norms, but interestingly, in all the studies I've worked on in the Middle East on sort of attitudes with women, it is, for some reason, women seem to be accepting violence more than men. I don't know if men, for some reason, underreport and women overreport, but there is something going on that there is an intergenerational sort of acceptance of violence where women themselves are participating in this. So definitely involve men, but don't assume that all women think that violence against women is, you know, despicable. Not really. I mean, so Sharia law, I included Sharia law because that is different family law. So in terms of what happens when you get a divorce, what happens, you know, there are different implications if you're under Sharia law or not under Sharia law. But I don't, I'm not convinced that there is, I don't know. I mean, there's a protective effect in this sample. I think there's interesting research coming out of a study in Bangladesh, which is also Muslim, that is prospective, looking at violence. But I'm not sure in which direction it would go. Clearly, gender norms have a link to religion, but they go way beyond that. Gender norms are often, I lived in Lebanon for a number of years, and gender norms were not based on religious group. It was more based on your economic class and things like that, whether a woman was okay to go out in public and things like that. So I think religion is one component, but there's more going on. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, since I was using the DHS data, I wasn't involved in any way in the data collection, right? So there may be, I think that is an interesting point, you know, would there be differential sort of reporting by state because of the way the questionnaire was administered? The DHS usually does a good job in terms of having peer interviewers and things like that, where you would make women feel comfortable reporting whether you're doing it in one state or the other. And I think, you know, but that is something to think about for the future. But no, we weren't involved in the actual data collection.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they don't ask about sort of that. They ask women whether they've seen their father beat their mother. So there is something intergenerational going there. But in terms of norms, the question, I mean, I can read it to you if you want specifically. It says, sometimes a husband is annoyed or angered by things which his wife does. So they ask this to married men, unmarried men, women under the age of, you know, the entire sample, married and unmarried women. In your opinion, is a husband justified in hitting or beating his wife in the following situations? Wife burns the food, if wife argues with the husband, if wife goes out without informing her husband, if wife neglects the children, if wife refuses to have sexual relations with the husband. So it's an abstract question asked of all men and women living in the state who were sampled. Yeah, we created four groups, and I need to go back to my my data. But yeah, we created four groups in terms of ethnic affiliation, and we controlled, you know, we include them as control variables. So the Fulani and Hausa, the Igbo, the Yoruba, and then other. And it was basically just because of the percentage of women. You know, there were, other was a huge category, clearly, but it wasn't in terms of absolute numbers of women. And there was significance with Igbo women reporting more violence, but we didn't find that that was something that we had enough qualitative data and enough nuance to really talk about. Again, we're controlling for that because it's important to make the case that the factors that you find at the state level are not just a sum of the individuals. So that's why you control for all the individual level factors to say above and beyond the characteristics of the people living in the state, there's something going on in terms of laws, state norms. And again, we weren't able to explain all the variation at the state level through the variables that we included. So there's more going on than what we were able to explore. And so it's more of a call for further research, what could be other contextual variables that are important, and not sort of saying, we know everything about Nigeria now, let's go intervene just on norms. It's just like a starting paper. Okay, thank you so much.